Before the stone bridge, Zed paused, gazing back down the wide road leading up the mountainside. Only the wind in the trees and their shimmering leaves created any sound or movement. For a long moment, though, he stared down at the empty road. Finally, he turned back to the bridge that in less than 300 paces spanned a chasm with near vertical sides dropping away for thousands of feet. Clouds far below hung hard against the sheer rock walls. Despite the countless times he had walked over the stone bridge, it still made him feel just a little queasy. Without wings, though, there was but this single way into the keep, except for the little trick passage he had used as a boy. Because of their strategic role, Zed had placed enough snares and traps along the bridge and the rest of the road, up to the keep, that no one was going to live for more than a few paces once they came close. Not even a sister of the dark could trespass here. A few sisters had attempted the impossible and had paid with their lives. They would have suspected such webs laid by the first wizard himself and felt some of the warning shields, but no doubt Jagang had given them no choice in the matter and had sent them to attempt entry, sacrificing their lives for the greater good of the order. Verna had once briefly been taken captive by the Dreamwalker, and she had told Zed all about the experience in the hope that they might find a counter, other than swearing loyalty in one's heart to the Lord Rahl and thereby invoking the protection of the bond. Zed had tried, but there was no counter magic he could provide. In the Great War, wizards far more talented than he, and with both sides of the gift, had tried to devise defenses against Dreamwalkers. Once the Dreamwalker had taken over a person's mind, there was no defense. You had to do his bidding, regardless of the cost, even if the cost was your life. Zed suspected that for a few, death was a coveted release from the agony of possession by the Dreamwalker. Suicide was a course blocked by Jagang. He needed the talents of the sisters and other gifted. He couldn't have them all kill themselves for release from the misery of life as his chattel. But if he sent them to their certain death, such as attempting to enter the keep, then they could at last be free of the agony that had become their life. Ahead, the keep towered on the mountainside. The soaring walls of dark stone, intimidating to most people, offered Zed the warm sense of home. His eyes roamed the ramparts, and he remembered strolling there with his wife so many years ago, a lifetime ago it seemed. From the towers, he had often looked down at the beautiful sight of Adendrill below. He had once marched across the bridges and passageways to deliver orders defending the Midlands from an invasion from Dahara, led by Darkin Rahl's father. That, too, seemed a lifetime ago. Now Richard, his grandson, was the Lord Rahl, and had succeeded in uniting most of the Midlands under the rule of the Daharan Empire. Zed shook his head at the wonder of it, at the thought of how Richard had changed everything. By Richard's hand, Zed was now a subject of the Daharan Empire. What a wonder indeed! Before he reached the far side of the bridge, Zed glanced down into the chasm. Movement caught his attention. Putting his bony fingers on the rough stone, he leaned out a little for a look. Below, but above the clouds, he saw two huge birds, black as moonless midnight, gliding along through the split in the mountain. Zed had never seen the like of them. He couldn't imagine what to make of the sight. When he turned back to the keep, he thought he saw three more of the same kind of large black birds flying together high above the keep. He decided that they had to be ravens. Ravens were big. He must simply be misjudging the distance, probably from lack of food. Concluding that they had to be ravens, he tried to adjust his estimation of their distance, but they were already gone. He glanced down but didn't see the other two either. As he passed under the iron portcullis, feeling the warm embrace of the keep's spell, Zed felt a wave of loneliness. He so missed Erilyn, his long-dead wife, as well as his long-past daughter, Richard's mother, and dear spirits, he missed Richard. He smiled then, thinking of Richard being with his own wife now. It was still sometimes hard for him to think of Richard as grown into a man. He had had a wondrous time helping to raise Richard. What a time that had been in his life, off in Westland, away from the Midlands, away from magic and responsibility, with just that ever-curious boy and a whole world of wonders to explore and show him. What a time indeed. Inside the keep, lamps along the wall obediently sprang to flame as First Wizard Zedekus Zol Zorander made his way along passageways and through grand rooms deeper into the immense mountain fortress. As he passed the webs he'd placed, he checked the texture of their magic to find that they were undisturbed. He sighed in relief. He didn't expect that anyone would be foolish enough to try to enter the keep. But the world had fools to spare. He didn't really like leaving such dangerous webs cast all about the place, in addition to the often dangerous shields already guarding the keep. But he dared not relax his guard. As he passed a long side table in a towering gathering hall, Zed, as he had done since he was a boy, ran his finger along the smooth groove in the edge of the variegated chocolate-brown marble top. He stopped, frowning down at the table, and realized that it contained something he suddenly felt the want of. A ball of fine black cord left there years ago to tie ribbons and other decorations on the lamp brackets in the gathering hall to mark the harvest festival. Sure enough, in the center drawer, he found the ball of fine cord. He snatched it up and slipped it into a pocket long emptied of its load of berries. From the wall bracket beside the table, he lifted a wand with six small bells. The wand, one of hundreds, if not thousands, throughout the keep, was once used to summon servants. He sighed inwardly. It had been decades since servants and their families last lived in the wizard's keep. He remembered their children running and playing in the halls. He remembered the joy of laughter echoing throughout the keep, bringing life to the place. Zed told himself that one day children would again run and laugh in the halls. Richard and Kalen's children. Zed's broad smile stretched his cheeks. There were windows and openings in the stone that let light spill into many halls and rooms, but there were other places less well lit. Zed found one of those darker places that was dim enough to satisfy him. He stretched a piece of the black cord strung with one of the bells across the doorway, winding it around coarse stone molding to each side. Moving deeper through the labyrinth of halls and passageways, he stopped and strung more strings with the bell at places where it would be hard to see. He had to collect several more of the servant wands for a supply of bells. Although there were shields of magic laced everywhere, there was no telling what power some of the Sisters of the Dark possessed. They would be looking for magic, not bells. It couldn't hurt to take the extra precaution. Zed made mental notes of where he strung the fine black cord. He would have to let Addie know. He doubted, though, that with her gifted sight, she would need the warning. He was sure that with her blind eyes, she could see better than anyone. Following the wondrous aroma of ham stew, Zed made his way to the comfortable room lined with bookshelves they used most of the time. Addie had hung spices to dry from the low beams carved with ancient designs. A leather couch sat before a broad fireplace and comfortable chairs beside a silver-inlaid table placed in front of a diamond-patterned leaded window with a breathtaking view overlooking Adendrill. The sun was setting, leaving the city below bathed in a warm light. It almost looked like it always did, except there was no telltale smoke curling up from cooking fires. Zed set his burlap sack loaded with his harvest on piles of books atop a round mahogany table behind the couch. He shuffled closer to the fire, all the while taking deep breaths to inhale the intoxicating aroma of the stew.
"Addie," he called, "this smells delightful. Have you looked outside today? I saw the oddest birds."
He smiled as he inhaled another whiff.
"Addie, I think it must be done by now."
He called toward the doorway to the side pantry room.
"I think we ought to taste it at least. Can't hurt to check, you know."
Zed glanced back over his shoulder.
"Addie, are you listening to me?"
He went to the doorway and peered into the pantry. But it was empty.
"Addie?"
He called down the stairs at the back of the pantry.
"Are you down there?"
Zed's mouth twisted with discontentment when she didn't answer.
"Addie!"
he called again.
"Bags, woman, where are you?"
He turned back, peering at the stew bubbling in the kettle hung on the crane over the fire. Zed scooped up a long wooden spoon from a pantry cupboard. Spoon in hand, he stopped and leaned back toward the stairs.
Take your time, Eddie. I'll just be up here, reading.
Zed grinned and hurried for the stew. Chapter 13. Richard rose up in a rush when he saw Kara marching up a ravine toward camp, pushing ahead of her a man Richard vaguely recognized. In the failing light, he couldn't make out the man's face. Richard scanned the surrounding flat washes, rocky hills, and steep, tree-covered slopes beyond, but didn't see anyone else. Friedrich was off to the south and Tom to the west, checking the surrounding country, as Kara had been, to be sure there was no one about and that it was a safe place to spend the night. They were exhausted from picking a sinuous route through the increasingly rugged country. Kara had been checking north, the direction they were headed, and the direction Richard considered potentially the most dangerous. Jensen turned from the animals, waiting to see who the moored Sith had with her. Once on his feet, Richard wished he hadn't gotten up quite so quickly. Doing so made him lightheaded. He couldn't seem to shake the odd, disconnected sensation he felt, as if he were watching someone else react, talk, move. When he concentrated, forcing himself to focus his attention, the feeling would sometimes drift at least partly away, and he would begin to wonder if it was only his imagination. Kaylin's hand slipped up on his arm, gripping him, as if she thought he might fall. "Are you all right?" she whispered. He nodded as he watched Kara and the man, as he also kept an eye on the surrounding countryside. By the end of their ride earlier that afternoon to discuss the book, Kaylin had become even more worried about him. They were both troubled about what he'd read, but Kaylin was far more concerned at the moment, anyway, about him. Richard suspected that he might be coming down with a slight fever. That would explain why he was feeling so cold when everyone else was hot. From time to time, Kaylin would feel his forehead or place the back of her hand against his cheek. Her touch warmed his heart. She ignored his smiles as she fretted over him. She thought that he might be slightly feverish. Once, she had Jensen feel his forehead to see if she thought he might be warmer than he should be. Jensen, too, thought that if he did have a fever, it was minor. Kara, so far, had been satisfied by Kaylin's report that he didn't feel feverish and hadn't deemed it necessary to see for herself. A fever was just about the last thing Richard needed. There were important something. He couldn't seem to recall at the moment. He concentrated on trying to remember the young man's name, or at least where he had seen him before. The last rays of the setting sun cast a pink glow across the mountains to the east. The closer hills were dimming to a soft gray in the gathering dusk. As darkness approached, the low fire was beginning to tint everything close around it a warm yellow-orange. Richard had kept the cook fire small, not wanting it to signal their location any more than necessary. "Lord Rawl," the man said in a reverent tone as he stepped into camp. He dipped his head forward in a hesitant bow, apparently not sure if it was proper to bow or not. "It's an honor to see you again." He was perhaps a couple of years younger than Richard, with curly black hair that brushed the broad shoulders of his buckskin tunic. He wore a long knife at his belt, but no sword. His ears stuck out to the sides of his head as if he were straining to listen to every little sound. Richard imagined that as a boy he'd probably endured a lot of taunts about his ears, but now that he was a man, his ears made him look rather intent and serious. As muscular as the man was, Richard doubted that he still had to contend with taunts. I'm sorry, but I can't quite seem to recall... "Oh, no, you wouldn't remember me, Lord Rawl. I was only..."
"Sabar!"
Richard said as it came to him.
"Sabar! You loaded the furnaces in Priska's foundry back in Alterang."
Sabar beamed.
"That's right. I can't believe you remember me."
Sabar had been one of the men at the foundry able to have work because of the supplies Richard hauled to Priska when no one else could. Sabar had understood how hard Priska worked just to keep his foundry alive under the oppressive, endless, and contradictory mandates of the Order. Sabar had been there the day the statue Richard carved had been unveiled. He had seen it before it was destroyed. He had been there at the beginning of the revolution in Alterang, fighting close alongside Victor, Prisca, and all the others who had seized the moment when it was upon them. Sabar had fought to help gain freedom for himself, his friends, and for his city. That had been a day everything had changed. Even though this man, like many others, had been a subject of the Imperial Order, one of the enemy, he wanted to live his own life under just laws, rather than under the dictates of despots who extinguished any hope of bettering oneself under the crushing burden of the cruel illusion of a greater good. Richard noticed then that everyone was standing in tense anticipation, as if they had expected this to be trouble. Richard smiled at Kara. "It's all right, I know him." "So he told me," Kara said. She put a hand on Sabar's shoulder and pushed him down. "Have a seat." "Yes," Richard said, glad to see that Kara had been fairly amiable about it. "Sit down and tell us why you're here." "Nikki sent me." Richard rose again in a rush, Kaelin coming up right beside him. "Nikki? We're on our way to meet her." Sabar nodded, rising into a half-crouch, seeming not to be sure if he was supposed to stand, since Richard and Kaelin had, or stay seated. Kara hadn't sat down. She stood behind Sabar like an executioner. Kara had been there when the revolution in Alterang had started and might remember Sabar, but that would make no difference. Kara trusted no one where the safety of Richard and Kaelin was concerned. Richard gestured for Sabar to remain seated. "Where is she?" Richard asked, as he and Kaelin sat down again, sharing a seat on a bedroll. "Is she coming soon?" "Nikki said to tell you that she waited as long as she could, but there have been some urgent developments, and she could wait no longer." Richard let out a disappointed sigh. "Some things came up for us, too." Kaelin had been captured and taken to the Pillars of Creation as bait to lure Richard into a trap. Rather than go into all that, he kept the story short and to the point. "We were trying to get to Nikki, but needed to go elsewhere. It was unavoidable." Sabar nodded. "I was worried when she returned to us and said that you had not shown up at your meeting place, but she told us that she was sure you were busy taking care of something important, and that was the reason you had not come. Victor Casella, the blacksmith, was very worried too when Nikki told us this. He was thinking you would be returning with Nikki. He said that other places he knows, places he and Prisca have dealings with for supplies and such, are on the verge of revolt. These people have heard about Alterang, how the order has been overthrown there, and how people are beginning to prosper. He said that he knows free men in those places who struggle to survive under the oppression of the order as we once did, and they hunger to be free. They want Victor's help. Some of the brothers in the Fellowship of the Order who escaped from Alterang have gone to these other places to ensure that such revolt does not spread there. Their cruelty in punishing any they suspect of insurrection is costing the lives of many people, both the innocent and those valuable to the cause of overthrowing the Imperial Order. In order to ensure their control of the gears of governance, and to ready the Order's defense against the spread of the revolt, brothers of the Order have gone to all the important cities. Surely some of these priests have also gone to report to Jigang the fall of Alterang, of the loss of so many officials in the fighting there, and of the deaths of brothers Narev and many of his close circle of disciples." "Jigang already knows of the death of brother Narev," Jensen said, offering him a cup of water. Sabar smiled his satisfaction at her news. He thanked her for the water, then leaned forward toward Richard and Kaelin as he went on with his story. "Prisca thinks the Order will want to sweep away the success of the revolt in Alterang, that they can't afford to let it stand. He said that instead of worrying about spreading the revolt, we must prepare, make defenses, and have every man stand ready because the Order will return with the intent of slaughtering every last person in Alterang." Sabar hesitated, clearly worried about Prisca's warning. "Victor, though, said that we should hammer the iron while it is hot and create a just and secure future for ourselves, rather than waiting for the Order to gather their strength to deny us that future. He says that if the revolt is spreading everywhere, the Order will not so easily stamp it out." Richard ran a weary hand across his face. "Victor is right. If those in Alterang try to sit alone as a singular place of freedom in the heart of hostile enemy territory, the Order will sweep in and cut out that heart. The Order can't survive on its perverted ideals, and they know it. That's why they must use force to sustain their beliefs. Without that bully of force, the Order will crumble." Jigang spent 20 years creating a system of roads to knit a diverse and fractured old world together into the Imperial Order. That was but part of the means of how he succeeded. Many resisted the rantings of his priests. With roads to swiftly respond to any dissent, though, Jigang was able to react quickly, to sweep in and kill those who openly opposed his new order. More importantly, after eliminating those who resisted the order's teachings, he filled the minds of children who didn't know any better with blind faith in those teachings, turning them into zealots eager to die for what they were taught was a noble cause, sacrificed to some all-consuming greater good. Those young men, their minds twisted with the teachings of the order, are now off to the north, conquering the new world, butchering any who will not take up their altruistic tenets. But while Jigang and that vast army are to the north, that strength there leaves the order weak here. That weakness is our opportunity, and we must capitalize on it. Now, while Jigang and his men are absent, those same roads he built down here will be our means of rapidly spreading the struggle for freedom far and wide. The torch of freedom has been lit by the will of those like you, those in all Terang who seized liberty for themselves. The flames of that torch must be held high, giving others the chance to see its light. If hidden and insulated, such flames will be extinguished by the order. There may never be another chance in our lifetimes or our children's lifetimes to seize control of our own lives. That torch must be carried to other places. Sabar smiled, filled with quiet pride that he had been a part of it all coming to be. I know that Victor would like for others like Priska to be reminded of such things, of what the Lord Rawl would say about what we must do. Victor wants to talk to you before he goes to these places to pump the bellows, as he put it. Victor said that he awaits your word on how you would move next, on how best to put the white-hot iron to them. Again, his words. So Nikki sent you to find me. Yes, and I was happy to go to you when she asked me. Victor will be happy too. Not only that you are well, but to hear what the Lord Rawl would say to him. While Victor was awaiting word, Richard knew also that absent such word, Victor would act. The revolution did not revolve around Richard. It couldn't to be successful, but around the hunger of people to have their lives back. Still, Richard needed to help coordinate the spreading revolt in order to be sure it was as effective as possible, not just at bringing freedom to those who sought it, but at crumbling the foundation of the order in the old world. Only if they were successful in toppling the rule of the order in the old world would Jigang's attention, and many of his men, be pulled away from conquering the new world. Jigang intended to conquer the new world by first dividing it. Richard had to do the same if he was to succeed. Only dividing the Order's forces could defeat it. Richard knew that with everyone evacuated from Adendrill, the Imperial Order would now turn its swords on Dahara. Despite the competence of the Daharan troops, they would be overwhelmed by the numbers that Jigang would throw at them. If the Order was not diverted from its cause, or at least divided into smaller forces, Dahara would fall under the shadow of the Order. The Daharan Empire, forged to unite the new world against tyranny, would end before it had really gotten started. Richard had to get back to Victor and Nikki so that they could all continue what they had begun, devising the most effective strategy to overthrow the Imperial Order. But they were running out of time to resolve another problem, a problem they didn't yet understand. I'm glad you found us, Sabar. You can tell Victor and Nikki that we need to see to something first, but as soon as we do, we'll be able to help them with their plans. Sabar looked relieved. Everyone will be happy to hear this. Sabar hesitated, then tilted his head, gesturing north. Lord Rawl, when I came to find you, following the directions Nikki gave me, I went past the area where she was to meet you, and then I continued coming south. Worry stole into his expression. Not many days ago, I came to a place miles wide that was dead. Richard looked up. He realized that his headache seemed to be suddenly gone. What do you mean, dead? Sabar waved his hand out toward the evening gloom. The area where I was traveling was much like this place. There were some trees, clumps of grass, thickets of brush. His voice lowered. But then I came to a place where everything that grew ended. All at the same place. There was nothing but rock beyond. Nikki had not told me that I would come to such a place. I admit I was afraid. Richard glanced to his right, to the east, to the mountains that lay beyond. How long did this dead place last? I walked, leaving life behind, and I thought I might be walking into the underworld itself. Sabar looked away from Richard's eyes, or into the jaws of some new weapon the Order had created to destroy us all. I came to be very afraid, and I was going to turn back. But then I thought about how the Order made me afraid my whole life, and I didn't like that feeling. Worse, I thought about how I would stand before Nikki and tell her I turned around rather than go to Lord Rawl, as she asked of me. And that thought made me ashamed, so I went on. In several miles, I came again to growing things. He let out a breath. I was greatly relieved. And then I felt a little foolish that I had been afraid. 2. That now made 2 of the strange boundaries. I've been to places like that, Sabar, and I can tell you that I, too, have been afraid. Sabar broke into a grin. Then I was not so foolish to be afraid? Not foolish at all. Could you tell if this dead area was extensive? Could you tell me if it was more than just a patch of open rock in that one place? Could you see if it ran in a line, ran in any direction in particular? It was like you say, like a line. Sabar flicked his hand toward the east. It came down out of the far mountains, north of that depression. He held his hand flat like a cleaver and sliced it downward in the other direction. It ran off to the southwest, into that wasteland. Toward the pillars of creation. Kaelin leaned close and spoke under her breath. That would be almost parallel to the boundary we crossed not far back to the south. Why would there be 2 boundaries so close together? That makes no sense. I don't know, Richard whispered to her. Maybe whatever the boundary was protecting was so dangerous that whoever placed it feared that one might not be enough. Kaelin rubbed her upper arms, but didn't comment. By the look on her face, Richard knew how she felt about such a notion, especially considering that those boundaries were now down. Anyway, Sabar said with a self-conscious shrug, I was happy I did not turn back, or I would have had to face Nikki after she had asked me to help Lord Rawl, my friend Richard. Richard smiled. I'm glad too, Sabar. I don't think that place you went through is a danger any longer, at least not a danger the way it was once. Jensen could contain her curiosity no longer. Who is this Nikki? Nikki is a sorceress, Richard said. She used to be a sister of the dark. Jensen's eyebrows went up. Used to? Richard nodded. She worked to further Jigang's cause, but she finally came to see how wrong she had been and joined our side. It was a story he didn't really feel like going into. She now fights for us. Her help has been invaluable. Jensen leaned in, even more astonished. But can you trust someone like that? Someone who had labored on behalf of Jigang? Worse, a sister of the dark? Richard, I've been with some of those women. I know how ruthless they are. They may have to do as Jigang makes them, but they're devoted to the Keeper of the Underworld. Do you really think you can trust with your life that she will not betray you? Richard looked Jensen in the eye. I trust you with a knife while I sleep. Jensen sat back up. She smiled, more out of embarrassment than anything else, Richard thought. I guess I see your point. What else did Nikki say? Kaelin asked, keen to get back to the matter at hand. Only that I must go in her place and meet you, Sabar said. Richard knew that Nikki was being cautious. She didn't want to tell the young man too much in case he was caught. How did she know where I was? She said that she was able to tell where you were by magic. Nikki is as powerful with magic as she is beautiful. Sabar said this in a tone of awe. He didn't know the half of it. Nikki was one of the most powerful sorceresses ever to have lived. Sabar didn't know that when Nikki was laboring toward the end sought by the Order, she was known as Death's Mistress. Richard surmised that Nikki had somehow used the bond to the Lord Rawl to find him. That bond was loyalty sworn in the heart, not by rote. And its power protected those so sworn from the Dreamwalker entering their minds. Full-blooded Daharans, like Kara, could tell through the bond where the Lord Rawl was. Kaelin had confided to him, that she found it unnerving the way Kara always knew where Richard was. Nikki wasn't Daharan, but she was a sorceress, and she was bonded to Richard, so she might have been able to manipulate that bond to tell where he was. Sabar, Nikki must have sent you to us for a reason, Richard said, other than to say that she couldn't wait for us at our meeting place.
Yes, of course, Sabar said as he nodded hastily, as if chagrined to have to be reminded. When I asked her what I was to say to you, she told me that she had put it all in a letter.
Sabar opened the leather flap of the pouch on his belt.
She said that when she realized how far away you really were, she was distraught and couldn't take the time to journey to you. She told me that it was important for me to be sure I found you and gave you this letter. She said the letter would explain why she couldn't wait.
With one finger and a thumb, Sabar lifted out the letter, looking as if he were handling a deadly viper instead of a small roll sealed with red wax.
Nikki told me that this is dangerous, he explained, looking up into Richard's eyes. She said that if anyone but you opened it, I should not be standing too close, or I would die with them.
Sabar carefully laid the rolled letter on Richard's palm. It warmed appreciably in his hand. The red wax brightened, as if lit by a ray of sunlight, even though it was getting dark. The glow spread from the wax to envelop the whole length of the rolled letter. Fine cracks raced all across the red wax, like autumn ice on a pond breaking up under the weight of a foot placed on it. The wax suddenly shattered and crumbled away. Sabar swallowed.
I hate to think of what would have happened had anyone but you tried to open it.
Jensen leaned in again.
Was that magic?
Must have been, Richard told her, as he started to unroll the letter.
But I saw it fall apart, she said in a confidential tone.
Did you see anything else?
No, it just all of a sudden crumbled.
With a thumb and finger, Richard lifted some of the disintegrated wax from his palm. She probably put a web of magic around the letter and keyed that spell to my touch. If anyone else had tried to break that web to open the letter, it would have ignited the spell. I guess that my touch unlocked the seal. You saw the result of the magic, the broken seal, not the magic itself.
Oh, wait! Sabar smacked his forehead with the flat of his palm. What am I thinking? I'm supposed to give you this, too.
Shrugging the straps off his shoulders and down his arms, he pulled his pack around onto his lap. He quickly undid the leather thongs and reached inside, then carefully lifted out something wrapped in black quilted material. It was only about a foot tall, but not very big around. By the way Sabar handled it, it appeared to be somewhat heavy. Sabar set the wrapped object on the ground upright in front of the fire.
Nikki told me that I should give this to you, that the letter would explain it.
Jensen leaned in a little, fascinated by the mystery of the tightly wrapped object.
What is it?
Sabar shrugged. Nikki didn't tell me.
He made a face that suggested he was somewhat uncomfortable with the way he was in the dark about much of the mission he'd been sent on. When Nikki looks at you and tells you to do something, it goes out of your head to ask questions. Richard smiled to himself as he began to unroll the letter. He knew all too well what Sabar meant.
Did Nikki say anything about who could unwrap that thing?
No, Lord Rawl. She just said to give it to you, that the letter would explain it.
If it had a web around it like the letter, she would have warned you.
Richard looked up. Kara, he said, gesturing at the bundled package sitting before the fire. Why don't you unwrap it while Kaelin and I read the letter? As Kara sat cross-legged on the ground and started working on the knots in the leather thongs around the black quilted wrap, Richard held the letter sideways a bit so that Kaelin could read it silently along with him.
Dear Richard and Kaelin, I am sorry that I cannot tell you everything right now that I would have you know, but there are urgent matters I must see to and I dare not delay. Jigang has initiated something I considered impossible.
Through his ability as a dreamwalker, he has forced Sisters of the Dark he controls to attempt to create weapons out of people, as was done during the Great War. This is dangerous enough in itself, but because Jigang does not have the gift, his understanding of such things is very crude. He is a blundering bull trying to use his horns to knit lace. They are using the lives of wizards as the fodder for his experiments.
I don't yet know the exact extent of their success, but I fear to discover the results. More of this in a moment. First, the object I sent. When I picked up your trail and began tracking it to where we were to meet, I discovered this. I believe you already have come across it because it has been touched by a principle involved in the matter or involved with you. The object is a warning beacon. It has been activated, not by this touch, but by events. I cannot overstate the danger it represents. Such objects could only be made by the wizards of ancient times. The creation of such an object required both additive and subtractive magic, and required the gift of both to be innate. Even then, they are so rare that I have never actually seen one. I have, however, read about them down in the vaults at the Palace of the Prophets. Such warning beacons are kept viable by a link to the dead wizard who created them. Richard sat back and let out a troubled breath. How can such a link be possible? Kaelin asked. He hardly had to read between the lines to be able to tell that Nikki was warning him in the gravest possible terms. It has to be linked somehow to the underworld, Richard whispered back. Little points of firelight danced in her green eyes as she stared at him. Kaelin glanced again at Kara as she worked at the knots, pulling off one of the leather thongs to an object linked to a dead wizard in the underworld. Kaelin held up the edge of the letter as she urgently read along with him. From what I know of such warning beacons, they monitor powerful and vital protective shields created to seal away something profoundly dangerous. They are paired. The first beacon is always amber. It is meant to be a warning to the one who caused the breach of the seal. The touch of a principal or one involved with a principal kindles it, so it may be recognized for what it is and serve as it was intended, as a warning to those involved. Only after alerting the one it is meant to warn can it be destroyed. I sent it to be absolutely certain you have seen it. The precise nature of the second beacon is unknown to me, but that beacon is meant for the one able to replace the seal. I don't know the nature of the seal or what it was protecting. Without doubt, though, the seal has been breached. The source of the breach, while not the specific cause activating this beacon, is self-evident. Oh, now wait a minute, Kara said, standing, backing away, as if she had released a deadly plague from the black quilting. It isn't my fault this time. She pointed down at it. You told me to this time. The translucent statue Kara had touched before now stood in the center of its unfolded black quilted wrapping. It was the same statue, a statue of Kaelin. The statue's left arm was pressed to its side, the right arm was raised, pointing. The statue, in an hourglass shape, looked as if it were made of transparent amber, allowing them to see inside. Sand trickled out of the top half of the hourglass, through the narrowed waist, into the bottom of the full dress of the Mother Confessor. The sand was still trickling down, just as it had been the last time Richard had seen the thing. At that time, the top half had been more full than the bottom half. Now the top held less sand than the bottom. Kaelin's face had gone ashen. When he'd first seen it, Richard wouldn't have needed Nikki to tell him how dangerous such a thing was. He hadn't wanted any of them to touch it. When they had first come across it, in a recess of rock beside the trail, looking almost like part of the rock itself, the thing was opaque, with a dull, dark surface. Yet it was clearly recognizable as Kaelin. It was lying on its side. Kara wasn't pleased to find such a thing and didn't want to leave a representation of Kaelin lying about for anyone to find and pick up for who knew what. Kara snatched it up, then, even though Richard started to yell at her to leave such a thing be. When she picked it up, it started turning translucent. In a panic, Kara set it back down. That was when the right arm had lifted and pointed east. That was when they could begin to see through the thing, to see the sand inside trickling down. The implied danger of the sand running out had them all upset. Kara wanted to pick it up again and turn it over to stop the sand from falling. Richard, not knowing anything about such an object and doubting that so simple a solution would have any beneficial effect, hadn't allowed Kara to touch it again. He had piled rocks and brush around it so no one else would know it was there. Obviously, that hadn't worked. He knew now that Kara's touch had nothing to do with what was happening except to initiate the warning, so he thought to confirm his original belief. Kara, put it down. down, on its side, like you wanted to do the last time, to see if that will stop the sand. Kara stared at him for a moment and then used the toe of her boot to tip the figure over on its side. The sand continued to run as if it still stood upright.
"How can the sand do that?" Jensen asked, sounding quite shaken. "How can the sand still fall? How can it fall sideways?"
"You can see it?" Kalen asked. "You can see the sand falling?" Jensen nodded.
"I sure can. And I have to tell you, it's giving my goosebumps goosebumps."
Richard could only stare at her, staring at the statue of Kalen lying on its side. If nothing else, the sand running sideways through the statue had to be magic. Jensen was a pillar of creation, a hole in the world, a pristinely ungifted offspring of Darken Rall. She should not be able to see magic. And yet, she was seeing it.
"I have to agree with the young lady," Sabar said. "That's even more frightening than those big black birds that I've seen circling for the last week."
Kalen straightened. "You've been seeing?" When he heard Tom's urgent warning yell, Richard rose up in a rush, drawing his sword in one swift movement. The unique sound of ringing steel filled the night air. The magic did not come out with the sword. Chapter 14. Kalen ducked to the side, out of harm's way as Richard pulled his sword free. The distinctive ring of steel being drawn in anger fused with Tom's warning yell still echoing through the surrounding hills to send a flash of fright tingling across her flesh. As she stared out into the empty blackness of the surrounding night, her instinct was to reach for her own sword. But she had packed it in the wagon rather than wear it, so as not to raise suspicions about who they might be. Women in the old world did not carry weapons. By the light of the fire, Kalen could clearly see Richard's face. She had seen him draw the Sword of Truth countless times and in a variety of situations, from that very first time when Zed, after giving him the sword, commanded him to draw it, and Richard tentatively pulled it from its scabbard, to times he pulled it free in the heat of battle, to times like this when he drew it suddenly in defense. When Richard drew the sword, he was also drawing its attendant magic. That was the function of the weapon. The magic had not been created simply to defend the sword's true owner, but more importantly, to be a projection of his intent. The Sword of Truth was not even really a talisman, but rather a tool of the Seeker of Truth. The true weapon was the rightly named Seeker who wielded the sword. The sword's magic answered to him. Each and every one of the times Richard had drawn the sword, Kalen had seen that magic dancing dangerously in his gray eyes. This was the first time he had drawn the sword that she didn't see the magic in his eyes. The raptor's glare was pure Richard. While seeing him draw the sword without seeing its concomitant magic evident in his eyes shocked her, it seemed to surprise Richard even more. For an instant he hesitated, as if mentally stumbling. Before they had time to even wonder what had prompted Tom's warning yell, shadowy shapes slipping through the cover of the nearby trees suddenly stormed out of the darkness and into their midst. The sudden sound and fury of blood-curdling cries filled the night air as men rampaged into the camp, lit at last by firelight. They didn't appear to be soldiers. They weren't wearing uniforms. And they weren't attacking as soldiers would with weapons drawn. Kalen didn't see any of the men brandishing swords or axes or even knives. Weapons or not, there were a lot of men, and they yelled fierce battle cries as if they intended nothing short of bloody murder. She knew, though, that the sudden shock of deafening noise was a tactic designed to render the intended target powerless with fright, making them easier to cut down. She knew, because she used such tactics herself. Blade in hand, Richard was fully in his element, focused, resolute, ruthlessly committed, even without his sword's attendant magic. As assailants charged in, the sword, driven by Richard's own wrath, flashed through the air, a flash of crimson light from the fire's flames reflected along the blade's length, lending it a fleeting stain of red. In that charged moment of attack met, there was a split second when Kalen feared that without the sword's magic, it all might go terribly wrong. In an instant, the camp that had been so quietly tense became pandemonium. Although the attackers weren't dressed like soldiers, they were all big, and as they swept in, there was no doubt whatsoever as to their hostile intent. A man rushing onward threw his arms up to seize Richard before his sword could be brought to bear. The sword's tip whistled as it came around, driven by deadly commitment. The blade severed one of the man's raised arms before exploding through his skull. The air above the fire filled with a spray of blood, bone, and brain. Another man lunged. Richard's sword ripped through his chest. In the space of two blinks, two men were dead. The magic at last seemed to slam into Richard's eyes, as if finally catching up with his intent. Kalen couldn't make sense of what the men were doing. They attacked without weapons drawn, but they seemed no less fierce for it. Their speed, numbers, and size, and the angry look of them were enough to make most anyone tremble in fright. From the darkness, more men rushed in on them. Kara stepped into the path of the attack, lashing out with her Aegil. Men cried out in horrifying pain when her weapon made contact, causing hesitation among the attackers. Sabar, knife in hand, tumbled to the ground with one of the men who had seized him from behind. Jensen ducked away from another man snatching for her hair. As she spun away from him, she slashed his face with her knife. His cries joined a strident chorus of others. Kalen realized that it wasn't just men yelling, but the horses were also screaming in fright. Kara's Aegil against a bull neck brought a terrifying shriek. Men yelled with effort and shouted orders that were cut off abruptly as Richard's sword tore through them. All the yelling seemed directed at the task of overwhelming the four of them. Kalen understood then what was going on. This was not an attempt to kill, but to capture. For these men, killing would be a great mercy compared to what they intended. Two of the burly men dove across the fire, arms spread wide as if to tackle Richard and Kalen. Kara reached out and seized a fistful of shirt, abruptly spinning one of two around. She drove her Aegil into his gut, dropping him to his knees. The other man unexpectedly encountered Richard's sword thrust straight in with formidable muscle driving it. The scream of mortal pain was brief before the sword slashed his throat. Kara, standing above the man on his knees, pressed her Aegil to his chest and gave it a twist that dropped him instantly. Already Richard was leaping over the fire to penetrate into the brunt of the attack. As his boots landed with a thud, his sword cut the man atop Sabar nearly in two, spilling his viscera across the ground. The man Jensen had slashed rose up only to be met by her knife driven by desperate fright. She jumped back as he tumbled forward, clutching the base of his throat where she had severed his windpipe. Kara snagged the man Jensen didn't see going for her back. The moored Sith, her face a picture of savage resolve, held her Aegil to his throat, following him to the ground as he choked on his own blood. Then, among the men Richard ripped into, Kalen saw the knives coming out. The men abandoned their failed attempt to bring him down by grabbing and overpowering him, and decided instead to knife him. If anything, the threat of the knives served only to further unleash Richard's fury. By the look in his eyes, the sword's magic seemed to be fully engaged in the battle. For an instant, Kalen stood transfixed by the sight of Richard so ruthlessly committed to self-defense that the act of killing became a graceful manifestation of art, a dance with death. Compared with Richard's fluid movements, the men blundered like bulls. Without wasted motion, Richard slipped among them, as if they were statues, his sword delivering unrestrained violence. Each thrust met a vital area of the enemy. Each swing sliced through flesh and bone. Each turn met an attack and crushed it. There was no lost opportunity, no slash that missed, no thrust gone wide, no bobble that only slightly wounded. Each time he spun past the thrust of a blade, met a rush, or turned to a new attack, he cut without mercy. Kalen was furious that she didn't have her sword. There was no telling how many more men were there. She knew all too well what it was like to be helpless and overwhelmed by a gang of men. She started edging toward the wagon. Jensen and Sabar were both tackled by a burly man diving in out of the darkness. As they hit the ground, the man landed atop them, knocking the wind from them. His big hands pinned their wrists to the ground, keeping their knives at bay. Richard's blade swept past with lightning speed, slicing through the man's back, severing his spine. Richard went to a knee as he turned, whipping the sword around to impale another attacker rushing in at a dead run, trying to get to Richard before he could recover. The look on the man's face was a picture of horrified surprise as he ran instead into Richard's sword, running it into his own chest, up to the hilt. The heavy man atop Jensen and Sabar convulsed, unable to draw a breath, as they threw him off. Richard, still on one knee, yanked the sword free as the mortally wounded man fell past him. As another man rushed into camp looking around, trying to get his bearings, Kara slammed her Ajeel against his neck. As he crumbled, she drove her elbow up to smash the face of a man following the first in, trying to grab her from behind while she was occupied. Crying out, his hands covered crushed bone and gushing blood. She spun and kicked him between the legs. As he fell forward, his hands going to his groin, she broke his jaw with her knee, turned and dropped a third man by slamming her Ajeel to his chest. Another attacker threw himself at Sabar, knocking him back. Sabar lashed out with his knife, making solid contact. Another man saw the opening and snatched up Nikki's letter lying on the ground. Kalen dove for the letter in his fist, but missed as he yanked his hand back before dashing away. Jensen blocked in his escape. He straight-armed her as he charged past. Jensen was knocked reeling, but came around to bury her knife between his shoulder blades. Jensen managed to keep hold of her knife, twisting it forcefully as the man arched his back with a gasp of pain, and then a bellow of anger that withered to a wet burble before it was fully out of his lungs. Jensen's knife had found his heart. He staggered, stumbled, and fell onto the fire. The flames whooshed to life as his clothing ignited. Kalen tried to snatch the letter from his fist as he writhed in horrifying pain, but with the intensity of the heat, she couldn't get close enough. It was already too late, though. The letter she and Richard had only had a chance to partially read flared briefly before transforming to black ash that disintegrated and lifted skyward in the roar of flames. Kalen covered her mouth and nose, gagging on the stench of burning hair and flesh as she was driven back by the heat. Though it seemed like hours of fighting, the assault had only just begun, and already men lay dead everywhere as yet more of the big men joined the attack. As she recoiled from the flames and her futile attempt to recover the lost letter, Kalen turned again toward the wagon, toward her sword. She looked up and saw a man who seemed as big as a mountain charging right at her, blocking her way. He grinned at seeing that he had run down a woman without a weapon. Beyond the man, Kalen saw Richard. Their eyes met. He had taken his sword to the bulk of the attack, trying to cut it down before it could get to the rest of them. Trying to end it before harm could get to any of the rest of them. He couldn't be everywhere at once. He wasn't close enough to get to her in time. That didn't stop him from trying. Even as he did, Kalen discounted the attempt. He was too far away. The effort was futile. Looking into the eyes of the man she loved more than life itself, she saw his pure rage. She knew that Richard was seeing a face that showed nothing, a confessor's face, as her mother had taught her. And then the racing enemy came between them, blocking their sight of one another. Kalen's vision focused on the man bearing down on her, his arms lifted like a bear lost in a mad charge. His teeth were gritted with determination. A grimace twisted his face in his wild effort to reach her before she could dodge to the side, before she had a chance to escape. She knew he was too close for her to have that chance, and so she didn't waste any effort in a useless attempt. This one had made it past the killing. He had avoided Jensen and Sabar. He had figured his attack to skirt Richard's blade while making it past Kara's Ajeel as she turned to another man. He hadn't charged in madly like the rest. He had delayed just enough to time his onslaught perfectly. This one knew he was on the verge of having what he sought. He was far less than a heartbeat away, plunging toward her at full speed. Kalen could hear Richard scream even as her gaze met the gleam of the man's dark eyes. The man let out a cry of rage as he lunged. His feet left the ground as he sailed through the air toward her. His wicked grin betrayed his confidence. Kalen could see his eye teeth hooked over his cracked lower lip, saw the dark tooth in the front of the top row between his other yellow teeth, saw the little white hook of a scar as if he had once been eating with a knife and had accidentally sliced the corner of his mouth. His stubble looked like wire. His left eye didn't open as wide as his right. His right ear had a big V-shaped notch taken out of the upper portion. It reminded her of the way some farmers marked their swine. She could see her own reflection in his dark eyes as her right arm came up. Kalen wondered if he had a wife, a woman who cared for him, missed him, pined for him. She wondered if he might have children, and if he did, what a man like this would teach his children. She had a momentary flash of the ugliness it would be to have this beast atop her, his wire stubble scraping her cheek raw, his cracked lips on hers, his yellow teeth raking her neck as he lost himself in what he wanted. time twisted. She held out her arm. The man crashed in toward her. She felt the coarse weave of his dark brown shirt as the flat of her hand met the center of his chest. That heartbeat of time she had before he was atop her had not yet begun. Richard had not yet managed to take a single frantic step. The weight of the bear of a man against her hand felt as if it were but a baby's breath. To Kaylin, it seemed as if he were frozen in space before her. Time was hers. He was hers. The rush of combat, the cries, the yells, the screams, the stink of sweat and blood, the flash of steel, the clash of bodies, the curses and growls, the fear, the terror, the heart-pounding dread, the rage was no longer there for her. She was in a silent world all her own. Even though she had been born with it, and had always felt it there in the core of her being, the awesome power within, in many ways, seemed incomprehensible, inconceivable, unimaginable, remote. She knew it would seem that way until she let her restraint slip. And then she would once again be joined with a force of such breathtaking magnitude that it could only be fully comprehended as it was being experienced. Although she had unleashed it more times than she could remember, no matter how prepared she was, the extraordinary violence of it always still astonished her. She regarded the man before her with cold calculation, ready for that violence. As he had charged in on her, time had belonged to this man. Now, time belonged to her. She could feel the thread count of the fabric of his shirt, feel his woolly chest hairs beneath it. The heart-pounding shock of the sudden attack, the violence of it, was gone now. Now there was only this man and her, forever linked by what was to happen. This man had consciously chosen his own fate when he chose to attack them. Her certainty of what was called for carried her beyond the need for the assessment of emotion, and she felt none, no joy, not even relief, no hate, not even aversion, no compassion, not even sorrow. Kaylin shed those emotions to make way for the rush of power, to give it free run. Now he had no chance. He was hers. The man's face was contorted with the intoxicated, gloating glee of his certitude that he was the glorious victor who would have her, that he was now the one to decide what was to become of her life, that she was but his to plunder. Kaylin unleashed her power. By her deliberate intent, the subordinate state of her birthright instantly altered into overpowering force, able to alter the very nature of consciousness. In the man's dark eyes had come the spark of suspicion that something which he could not comprehend had irrevocably begun. And then there came the lightning recognition that his life, as he had known it, was over. Everything he wanted, thought about, worked toward, hoped for, prayed for, possessed, loved, hated, was ended. In her eyes, he saw no mercy, and that, more than anything, brought him stark terror. Thunder without sound jolted the air. In that instant, the violence of it was as pristine, as beautiful, as exquisite as it was horrific. That heartbeat of time Kaylin had before he was on her had still not yet begun. She could see in the man's eyes that even thought itself was too late for him now. Perception itself was being outpaced by the race of brutal magic tearing through his mind, destroying forever who this man had been. The force of the concussion jolted the air. The stars shuddered. Sparks from the fire lashed along the ground as the shock spread outward in a ring, driving dust before its passing. Trees shook when hit by the blow, shedding needles and leaves as the raging wave swept past. He was hers. His full weight flying forward knocked Kaylin back a step as she twisted out of the way. The man flew past her and crashed to the ground, sprawling on his face. Without an instant of hesitation, he scrambled up onto his knees. His hands came up in prayerful supplication. Tears flooded his eyes. His mouth, which only an instant before was so warped with perverted expectation, now distorted with the agony of pure anguish. "Please, mistress," he wailed. "Command me." Kaylin regarded him, for the first time in his new life, with an emotion. Contempt. Chapter 15. Only the sound of Betty's soft, frightened bleating drifted out over the otherwise silent campsite. Bodies lay sprawled haphazardly across the ground. The attack appeared to be over. Richard, sword in hand, rushed through the carnage to get to Kalen. Jensen stood near the edge of the fire's light while Kara checked the bodies for any sign of life. Kalen left the man she had just touched with her power kneeling in the dirt, stalking past him toward Jensen. Richard met her halfway there, his free arms sweeping around her with relief. "Are you all right?" Kalen nodded, quickly appraising their camp, on the lookout for any more attackers, but saw only the men who were dead. "What about you?" she asked. Richard didn't seem to hear her question. His arms slipped from her waist. "Dear spirits," he said, as he rushed to one of the bodies lying on its side. It was Sabar. Jensen stood not far away, trembling with terror, her knife held up defensively in a fist, her eyes wide. Kalen gathered Jensen in her arms, whispering assurance that it was over, that it was ended, that she was all right. Jensen clutched at Kalen.
"Sabar, he was protecting me."
I know, Kalen comforted. She could see that there was no urgency in Richard's movements as he laid Sabar on his back. The young man's arm flopped lifelessly to the side. Kalen's heart sank. Tom ran into camp, gasping for air. He was streaked with blood and sweat. Jensen wailed and flew into his arms. He embraced her protectively, holding her head to his shoulder as he tried to regain his breath. Betty bleated in dismay from beneath the wagon, hesitantly emerging, only after Jensen called repeated encouragement to her. The puling goat finally rushed to Jensen and huddled trembling against her skirts. Tom kept a wary watch of the surrounding darkness. Kara calmly walked among the bodies, surveying them for any sign of life. With most, there could be no question. Here and there she nudged one with the toe of her boot, or with the tip of her ajeel. By her lack of urgency, there was no question that they were all dead. Kalen put a tender hand to Richard's back as he crouched beside Sabara's body.
"How many people must die?" he asked in a low, bitter voice. "For the crime of wanting to be free, for the sin of wanting to live their own life."
He saw that he still held the Sword of Truth in a white-knuckled fist. The sword's magic, which had come out so reluctantly, still danced dangerously in his eyes.
"How many?" he repeated.
"I don't know, Richard," Kalen whispered.
Richard turned a glare toward the man across the camp, still on his knees, his hands pressed together in a beseeching gesture, begging to be commanded, fearing to speak. Once touched by a confessor, the person was no longer who they had once been. That part of their mind was gone forever. Who they were, what they were, no longer existed. In its place, the magic of a confessor's power placed unqualified devotion to the wants and wishes of the confessor who had touched them. Nothing else mattered. Their only purpose in life now was to fulfill her commands, to do her bidding, to answer her every question. For one thus touched, there was no crime they wouldn't confess if she asked it of them. It was for this alone that confessors had been created. Their purpose, in a way, was the same as the seekers, the truth. In war, as in all other aspects of life, there was no more important commodity for survival than the truth. This man, kneeling not far away, cried in abject misery because Kalen had asked nothing of him. There could be no agony more ghastly, no void more terrifying, than to be empty of knowing her wish. Existence without her wish was pointless. In the absence of her command, men touched by a confessor had been known to die. Anything she now asked of him, whether it be to tell her his name, confess his true love's name, or to murder his beloved mother, would bring him boundless joy because he would finally have a task to carry out for her.
"Let's find out what this is all about," Richard said in a low growl.
In exhaustion, Kalen stared at the man on his knees. She was so weary she could hardly stand. Sweat trickled down between her breasts. She needed rest, but this problem was more immediate and needed to be attended to first. On their way to the man waiting on his knees, his eyes turned expectantly up toward Kalen, Richard halted. There, in the dirt before his boots, was the remains of the statue Sabar had brought to them. It was broken into 100 pieces, none of them any longer recognizable, except that those pieces were still a translucent amber color. Nikki's letter had said that they didn't need the statue, now that it had given its warning, a warning that Kalin had somehow broken a protective shield, sealing away something profoundly dangerous. Kalin didn't know what the seal protected, but she feared that she knew all too well what she had done to break it. She feared even more that, because of her, the magic of Richard's sword had begun to falter. As Kalin stood staring down at the amber fragments ground into the dirt, despair flooded into her. Richard's arm circled her waist. "Don't let your imagination get carried away. We don't know what this is about yet. We can't even be certain that it's true. It could even be some kind of mistake." Kalin wished that she could believe that. Richard finally slid his sword back into its scabbard. "Do you want to rest first? Sit a bit?" His concern for her took precedence over everything. From the first day she met him, it always had. Right then, it was his well-being that concerned her. Using her power sapped a confessor of strength. It had left Kalin feeling not only weak, but this time nauseated. She had been named to the post of Mother Confessor in part because her power was so strong that she was able to recover it in hours. For others, it had taken a day or sometimes two. At the thought of all those other confessors, some of whom she dearly loved, being long dead, Kalin felt the weight of hopelessness pulling her even lower. To fully recover her strength, she would need a night's rest. At the moment, though, there were more important considerations, not the least of which was Richard. "No," she said. "I'm all right. I can rest later. Let's ask him what you will." Richard's gaze moved over the campsite littered with limbs, entrails, bodies. The ground was soaked with blood. The stench of it all, along with the still smoldering body beside the fire, was making Kalin sicker by the second. She turned away from the man on his knees toward Richard, into the protection of his arms. She was exhausted. "And then let's get away from this place," she said. "We need to get away from here. There might be more men coming." Kalin worried that if he had to draw the sword again, he might not have the help of its magic. "We need to find a more secure camp." Richard nodded his agreement. He looked over her head as he held her to his chest. Despite everything, or perhaps because of everything, it felt wonderful simply to be held. She could hear Friedrich just rushing back into camp, panting as he ran. He stumbled to a halt as he let out a moan of astonishment mixed with revulsion at what he saw. "Tom, Friedrich," Richard asked, "do you have any idea if there are any more men coming?"
"I don't think so," Tom said. "I think they were all together. I caught them coming up a gully. I was going to try to make it back here to warn you, but four of them came over a rise and jumped me while the rest ran for our camp."
"I didn't see anyone, Lord Rawl," Friedrich said, catching his breath. "I came running when I heard the yelling."
Richard acknowledged Friedrich's words with a reassuring hand on the man's shoulder. "Help Tom get the horses hitched. I don't want to spend the night here." As the two men sprang into action, Richard turned to Jensen. "Please lay out some bedrolls in the back of the wagon, will you? I'd like Kalin to be able to lie down and rest when we move out." Jensen patted Betty's shoulder, urging the goat to follow her.
"Of course, Richard."
She hurried off to the wagon, Betty trotting along close at her side. As everyone rushed as quickly as possible to get their things together, Richard went by himself to an open patch of ground nearby to dig a shallow grave. There was no time for a funeral pyre. A lonely grave was the best they could do, but Sabar's spirit was gone and wouldn't fault the necessity of their hurried care for his body. Kalin reconsidered her thought. After the letter from Nikki, and learning the meaning of the warning beacon, she now had even more reason to doubt that many things, including spirits, were still true. The world of the dead was connected to the world of the living by links of magic. The veil itself was magic, and said to be within those like Richard. They had learned that without magic, those links themselves could fail, and that, since those other worlds couldn't exist independent of the world of life, but only existed in relational sense to the world of life, should the links fail completely, those other worlds might very well cease to exist, much as, without the sun, the concept of daytime would not exist. It was now clear to Kalin that the world's hold on magic was slipping, and had been slipping for several years. She knew the reason. Spirits, the good and the bad, and the existence of everything else that depended on magic, might soon be lost. That meant that death would become final, in every sense of the word. It could even be that there was no longer the possibility of being with a loved one after death, or of being with the good spirits. The good spirits, even the underworld itself, might be passing into nothingness. When Richard was finished, Tom helped him gently place Sabar's body in the ground. After Tom spoke quiet words, asking the good spirits to watch over one of their own, he and Richard covered the body over. "Lord Rawl," Tom said in a low voice when they were finished, "while some of the men began the attack on you here, others slit the horses' throats before joining their fellows to come after you for." "All of the horses?" "Except mine. My draft horses are pretty big. The men were probably worried about getting trampled. They left some men to take care of me, so these here thought they had me out of the way. They probably figured they could worry about the draft horses later." "After they had the rest of you." Tom shrugged his broad shoulders. "Maybe they even planned to capture you, tie you up, and take you in the wagon." Richard acknowledged Tom's words with a single nod. He wiped his fingers across his forehead. Kaelin thought he looked worse than she felt. She could see that the headache had returned and was crushing him under the weight of its pain. Tom looked around their camp, his gaze playing over the fallen men. "What should we do with the rest of the bodies?" "The races can have the rest of them," Richard said without hesitation. Tom didn't look to have any disagreement with that. "I'd better go help Friedrich finish getting the horses hitched to the wagon. There'll be a handful with the scent of blood in their nostrils and the sight of the others dead." As Tom went to see his horses, Richard called to Kara. "Count the bodies," he told her. "We need to know the total." "Richard?" Kaelin asked in a confidential tone after Tom was out of earshot and Kara had started stepping over some of the bodies and between others, going about the task of taking account. "What happened when you drew the sword?" He didn't ask what she meant or try to spare her from worry. "There's something wrong with its magic. When I drew the sword, it failed to heed my call. The men were rushing in, and I couldn't delay in what I had to do. Once I met the attack, the magic finally reacted." "It's probably due to the headaches from the gift. They must be interfering with my ability to join with the sword's magic." "The last time you had the headaches, they didn't interfere with the sword's power?" "I told you, don't let your imagination get carried away. This has only happened since I've started getting the headaches again. That has to be the reason." Kaelin didn't know if she dared believe him, or if he really even believed it himself. He was right, though. The problem with the sword's magic had only recently developed, after he started getting the headaches. "They're getting worse, aren't they?" He nodded. "Come on. Let's get what answers we can." Kaelin let out a tired sigh, resigned to that part of it. They had to use this chance to find out what information was now available to them. Kaelin turned to the man still on his knees. Chapter 16. The man's tearful eyes gazed pleadingly up at Kaelin as she stepped in front of him. He had been waiting alone and without her wishes for quite a while, and as a result was in a state of dire misery.